Your favorite tunes of the past. This is Oldies 104, Topeka.
Once again, it's time for the Internet Music Show, which makes people wish it was a terrestrial radio show. It's time for Rock House. If you're ready to rock, Rock House is ready for you. And it looks like William Beasley is already ready. I am on Facebook Live tonight for just a few minutes, along with my friend Mark Dillman, a.k.a. Daddy O'Dilly. And do we have a big-time show tonight, or what?
Yeah, we sure do. We're celebrating Black History Month by acknowledging two native Kansans who had a lot to do with the early rhythm and blues music.
You know, what's interesting, this being Black History Month, this being Rock House, a show dedicated to rock and roll and rhythm and blues, it's interesting, in the context of Black History Month, how many people have actually been oblivious to the fact that the foundations of rock and roll music were, for the most part, created by black musicians. Now, at some point, if you've been following, like I'm sure Terry Walton has, hello, Terry, if you've been following Ken Burns' country series, at some point, some of the country musicians and some of the black musicians were sort of cross-fertilizing a little bit.
And, looking over each other's shoulders.
And you had the phenomenon of rockabilly, which sort of sprung from that. But aside from that element, and someone made the point, I think it was even Hank Jr., someone made the point that Hank Williams Sr.'s Move It On Over was a logical predecessor for Bill Haley's Rock Around the Clock. Mm-hmm. So there was a certain amount of contribution from the countryside, but I would contend that probably 75 to 90% of it, the foundations of rock, were laid by black people. In fact, at the risk of sinking into a double entendre, speaking of laid, rock and roll itself was a synonym for an act of personal Congress.
Yes.
When Alan Freed and a few other headbangers started popularizing the term, a lot of kids just assumed that it meant the music.
Yeah.
And how were they going to know any different?
Mm-hmm.
So when they were using phrases like, I'm going to rock and roll with you all night long, well, they weren't talking about dancing to Bill Haley tunes all night long.
Right.
They were talking about a very specific activity.
That's right.
But and that aspect of it, that theme was only a part of it. A lot of it was just music dedicated to people getting together and having a good time.
Yeah.
But what is most egregious, yes, egregious, I say, here in the Sunflower State, and people listening at distant points, like Paul Schwartz down there in sun-drenched Florida, would probably agree with me. What is really sad is that two of the most significant figures in the development of early rock and roll music came from Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
And where are the Maxwell Davis statues? Where are the Jesse Stone statues? I mean, Jesse Stone, born in Atchison, Maxwell Davis? Tell us a little bit about Maxwell Davis.
Maxwell Davis was born in Independence back in 1916.
Southeast Kansas.
That's right, you know, here again. And whereas Jesse Stone made his mark on the East Coast, especially in the early years of the Atlantic record label, Maxwell Davis was on the West Coast and worked for a number of record labels out there, like the Aladdin label and the Modern label. Both of them were composers, arrangers, and conductors. And by arrangers, we mean the people who write the sheet music for each individual instrument in a band. Okay, that's what writing arrangements is. Jesse Stone was, a.k.a. Charles Calhoun, was a piano player, but Maxwell Davis was a tenor sax player, and they both were big contributors to rhythm and blues music and early rock and roll in the late 1940s and early 1950s, both from the Sunflower State, but they made their mark on separate coasts.
That they did. And one of the more well-known Jesse Stone efforts was a tune called Shake, Rattle, and Roll, which was also covered by Bill Haley and the Comets.
Mm-hmm.
And he also did one called Flip, Flop, and Fly.
You know, those two songs right there cement his reputation among everything else he did. My gosh, you know?
And then if you... I think the first Jesse Stone cut I'm going to play tonight, other than Flip, Flop, and Fly, is going to be a Ray Charles tune that he arranged. And if you go back and watch the movie Ray, there's a part of the movie where all the people are in the studio kind of trying to figure out what to do with Ray Charles. And there is a Jesse Stone character in that scene. And he's among those who helped Ray Charles record The Mess Around. That was the scene in the movie. All the confusion. Because at one time, Ray Charles was trying to sound like Charles Brown.
Yeah.
And that wasn't working out too good. And Jesse Stone helped figure out how to create a sound for Ray Charles that was his own sound and was a rockin' sound.
Unleash the real Ray Charles.
Yes, Ray Charles. Ray Charles gone wild. Well, we've got a got a lot of people on my Facebook Live page that I guess they're kind of dialing in and out, Linda and Don, Jeff Phelps up there in Pete Buttigieg country, or is it Bernie Sanders country? Who won that Iowa caucus thing anyway? And I noticed they even had my old college town, Grinnell, Iowa,
oh, yeah,
on the CNN feed that night last week. And then we have Dan and Joshua and Rich and Matt's up there in Michigan. So want to say hi to everybody, Kitty, everybody that's dialed in on Facebook Live tonight. And if you want to get over to oldies104.net or radiostorm.com and hear this in high fidelity, that's a good plan, because we have some really torrid music coming up for you. Starting with...
Oh, are we going to go with Maxwell Davis first?
Let's do that.
Okay, all right. Well,
let's jump right into Maxwell Davis.
Okay. Maxwell Davis recorded a lot of records with his own orchestra, and we're starting off tonight with one of his earliest ones. It's called the MT Boogie, and it's part of a wonderful 3-CD set called Wailin' Daddy, the Best of Maxwell Davis, which features him as a band leader and also as the arranger and accompaniment to other artists as well. And it's the first song we're going to play tonight.
Black History Month with a Kansas emphasis, Maxwell Davis. Yeah, there's Maxwell Davis in his prime. When was that recorded?
1945.
Okay.
The war is over. The boys are coming home.
That was 1945.
Yeah.
Yeah. Man, what was that called again?
TK Boogie. MT Boogie.
The MT Boogie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Roy Milton had one called the RM Blues.
That's a good one. Yeah.
And Maxwell Davis ended up on the Specialty label for a little while. I don't know that he recorded with Roy Milton, but he did some other things on Specialty that we will be playing here from time to time tonight. We did not mention, while talking about Black history in Kansas, we did not mention our blues performers for the evening. So you might want to tell us who we're going to be featuring tonight in the area of straight-up blues.
Well, because Maxwell Davis was a band leader and arranger at the Modern Record label, you're going to hear him several times tonight backing up Elmore James and B.B. King. Now, B.B. King, as you know, had a lot of hit records in the 1950s, and most of them have Maxwell Davis's band backing him up.
Elmore, on Modern?
On the Modern label, yeah.
A little sidebar about the Modern label. If I could.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Have you seen the movie about Dolemite?
I have not seen that yet. Well, no.
the guy, Rudy Ray Moore?
Right.
Okay, in real life, Rudy Ray Moore, the reason he got his stuff out there on record was the four Bihari brothers.
Right.
Who owned the Modern label. And they, as much as anyone else, helped him become a national, I should say, threat.
Yeah, that's right. A threat to the morals of America.
Not just a national brand, but a national threat.
He could almost make Red Fox blush almost, you know.
Yeah, you need to see that movie.
Yeah, I do.
You really do. Anyway, back to what you were saying about B.B. King and Maxwell Davis.
Yeah, and then Elmore James as well. I had the impression, I thought, that Elmore James had recorded quite a few songs for the in Los Angeles for the Modern label, but it turns out he only ever had just one session. It was his final session for the Modern label, and it's a grand total of six songs, and we've got them all queued up on an LP here tonight as well.
You want to hear Elmore James? We have Elmore James.
I think now would be the time to listen to Elmore James doing Late Hours After Midnight with Maxwell Davis and his orchestra.
Okay, this is going to come to you on succulent, crispy, authentic vinyl right now. What's that one called again?
That was Late Hours After Midnight by Elmore James. And like you say, him recording on the West Coast, give it a little bit more of a jazzier feel instead of the down-home Chicago or Memphis feel that you would hear on his other records.
Yeah, more of a smoother, better produced kind of sound.
Yeah.
Not that his others didn't sound great, but this was just a slightly different version of Elmore.
Well, you know, he had jazz musicians backing him up here, you know.
On that one?
Well, all of this.
Yeah, he had SoCal Cats.
Yeah, SoCal Cats.
SoCal Cats behind him.
Yeah.
You know, you can't get too depressed about anything when you're just 2 miles away from a beach.
That's right.
You know?
That's why California West Coast blues never sounds quite as sad as down south in Chicago and Detroit blues,
it's,
you know?
Nothing, not quite as drenched in despair.
That's right.
As, yeah, the urban blues of the upper Midwest. Well, I want to say hi to Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice. No, Bob and Carol. Tom, Roger T. Moore. We have a lot of distinguished guests on Facebook Live tonight. I hope they're all still watching. And if you are dialing into Rock House from time to time on Facebook Live, don't forget, you can pick up the high fidelity version by simply going onto the big set and listening to us on oldies104.net or radiostorm.com. My studio guest tonight is Daddy O'Dilly. We are digging deep into the Daddy O'Dilly archives to bring you a special on Black History Kansas musicians. This is Black History Month, and we have a couple of very significant musical figures who came from Kansas, who helped lay the foundations of rock and roll. We've been talking about Maxwell Davis. Now, we're going to switch over for just a minute to Jesse Stone, who, under the nom de plume, wrote this smash hit for Big Joe Turner, Flip Flop. And
fly. Now when I get the blues, I get me a rocking chair. When I get the blues, I get me a rocking chair. Well, the blues overtake me, gonna rock right away from here. Now when I get lonesome, I jump on the telephone. When I get lonesome, I jump on the telephone. I call my baby, tell him on my way back home. Now flip, flop, and fly, I don't care if I die. Now flip, flop, and fly, I don't care if I die. Don't ever leave me, don't ever say goodbye. Give me one more kiss, hold it a long, long time. Give me one more kiss, hold it a long, long time. Now love me, baby, do the feeling, hit my head like wine. Here comes my baby, flashing a new gold tooth. Here comes my baby, flashing a new gold tooth. Well, she's so small, she can mumble in a payphone booth. Now flip, flop, and fly, I don't care if I die. Now flip, flop, and fly, I don't care if I die. Now don't ever leave me, don't ever say goodbye. Mississippi bulldog sitting on a hollow stump. I got so many women, I don't know which way to jump. Now flip, flop, and fly, I don't care if I die. Now flip, flop, and fly, I don't care if I die. Now don't ever leave me, don't ever say goodbye. Oh my.
Oh my. That's Flip, Flop, and Fly, one of Jesse Stone's contributions to the early Atlantic ethos. And it says here that he was the arranger. Not only did he write it under the nom de plume of Charles Calhoun, he was also the arranger.
Now, which means that these guys could read sheet music.
Which, well, yeah, and you talked about that a second ago, but let's repeat that. What does it mean when someone does the arranging?
When an arranger writes sheet music for every single instrument in the band. If you notice, when you listen to a song, it isn't everybody plays the same note at the same time. It's not like that. All these instruments are playing intricately and weaving together the sound. And if you read sheet music and if you have arrangements ahead of time, that means you've got sheet music showing the notes for every instrument in the band. Now, there's a lot of small combos that don't need that. They don't use it. That's what's called head arrangements. But if it's written arrangements, that means that every instrument in the group has got their own unique set of sheet music to play.
And I understand that, contrary to that spirit, Big Joe Turner himself would just memorize all the songs.
Mm-hmm.
Had you heard that before?
Yeah.
He wasn't really into reading them.
Right.
Is that true?
It was the musician's job to read the arrangements and play them, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, I want to say hi to Patrick Wiles. We have a lot of illustrious guests joining us on Facebook Live tonight.
My Facebook group hasn't shown up yet. Usually okay. By this time, I've got a half a dozen or more calling in here.
Well, they'll be here sooner or later.
No doubt. So. When they're done shoveling their driveways.
Yeah, what we're doing tonight on Rock House, we are emphasizing the music of two gentlemen from Kansas, Maxwell Davis, who was a saxophone player, and Jesse Stone, who was an orchestra leader. He also created a female backup singing group called the Cookies, not to be confused with the Cookies who came along in the early 60s on Carole King's record label, but and did stuff like Don't Say Nothing Bad About My Baby and Chains. These Cookies were Jesse Stone's hand-picked singers, and then they did so well behind Ray Charles in a couple of cuts, which we'll hear later, that Ray Charles just appropriated them and turn them into the Raylettes.
The Raylettes, yeah.
So, anyway, those Cookies were just too sweet, I guess, for Jesse Stone. So, okay, we're getting into back into Maxwell Davis, I guess, right?
That's right. We'll hear our first of a handful of selections tonight by B.B. King from the 1950s, and this one's called You Upset Me, Baby.
She got a real crazy leg. You upsets me, baby. Yes, you upsets me, baby. Yes, I'm telling you people, she's something fine that you really ought to see. Well, she's not too tall, complexion is fair. Man, she knocks me out the way she wears her hair. You upsets me, baby. Yes, you upsets me, baby. Like being hit by a falling tree. Woman, woman, what you do to me? Well, I've tried to describe her. It's hard to start. I better stop now because I got a weak heart. You upsets me. Well, you upsets me, baby. Well, like being hit by a falling tree. Woman, what you do to me?
Thank you. a very weak heart. You upsets me, baby. Yes, you upsets me, baby. Well, like being hit by a falling tree. Woman, what you do to me?
I believe him when he says, "You upsets me, baby." He sounded upset. And that's B.B. King. Now, in addition to Maxwell Davis, in addition to Big Joe Turner and Jesse Stone, which is our Black History Month thing here on Rock House, we're playing some blues. You got, let's see, so far we've had Elmore James.
And B.B. King.
B.B. King.
Now you want to play Muddy Waters?
Okay, well, the next logical, yes, the next logical step would be to go to Muddy Waters.
Yep.
What are we going to hear by him?
Well, Muddy Waters, between 1977 and 1981, put out four albums on the Blue Sky label, which was a Columbia subsidiary. They were all produced by Johnny Winter, who joined in on guitar on those albums. They all sold really well, and three of them even won Grammy Awards. And so we'll hear a track from the first one of those. You might remember in the late 1970s, every time you went to a newsstand and looked at the magazines, there was always a cover portraits by Richard Avedon on the covers of everything.
Right.
Time Magazine, Newsweek, Gentleman's Quarterly, you name it. And son of a gun, here's Richard Avedon's portrait of Muddy Waters on the cover of this album, Hard Again, on the Blue Sky label. And if you notice, Richard Avedon's portraits was always from about slightly below waist up, black and white, looking straight at the camera, and with this kind of broken dark border around it with a white background. It was just a trademark of his portrait series, and sure enough, the King of the Chicago Blues was included in it.
It was the Avedon style.
That's right. And so these were the final albums that Muddy Waters recorded, and we'll play a track from one of these tonight called I Want to Be Loved.
I want to be loved. Crazy about every little thing you do. I even cherish your hug. Your kiss is so sweet, honey, thee can't they be. But baby, I want to be loved. Friend, I love the way you walk when you pass me by, even when you try to snub. The touch of your hand, honey, drives me insane. But baby, I want to be loved.
I think we just established that was it.
Yeah.
That was produced by
Johnny Winter.
Johnny Winter.
Yeah.
Wow.
He played a show in Lawrence just not long before he passed away. It was one of those free outdoor shows they would have in the summer downtown.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And we've been comparing notes. I just want to say, for the benefit of anybody dialing in on Facebook Live, this is Rock House. Marshall Barber here with my guest, Daddy O'Dilly. What's that on your shirt?
Johnny Otis.
Oh, Johnny, okay. Yeah. Let me give you a close-up of Daddy O'Dilly's attire tonight. Yeah, that's a good one.
This Johnny is Otis. The Ed Seaman collection of collage portrait T-shirts.
That's a good one.
Wonderful stuff, wonderful stuff. He was Frank Zappa's official cinematographer, the guy who designs
these
shirts.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Hi to Melissa Baumgartner, Terry Karch, and Jerome Bernard. My posse is finally showing up.
All right. Thanks
for listening, everybody.
The Daddy O'Dillians.
Yeah.
Millions of Daddy O'Dillians out there.
Millions of Daddy
O'Dillians. I'm not even sure that I have a record ready.
Well, why don't you cue this one up then?
Okay.
And I'll talk.
You talk.
Yeah.
You go. Oh, wait, I did have a record ready.
Oh, you do? Okay.
See how disorganized I am. I get something ready, and I don't even know it. I had another, I had another Jesse Stone composition here. What we are doing tonight on Rock House, in the midst of Black History Month, we are celebrating the legacy of a couple of Kansas natives, Jesse Stone and Maxwell Davis. Now, with regard to Jesse Stone, he not only arranged and produced a lot of great music, not only was he a renowned band leader on the Kansas City scene during the height of the Pendergast era in the 20s and early 30s.
Yeah.
Well, he also, under the nom de plume Charles Calhoun, wrote a lot of significant records, including Flip Flop and Fly, which we've already heard. And if you like Steve Miller, you might remember a Steve Miller Band song from the 70s, a recording, Your Cash Ain't Nothing But Trash.
Oh, yeah.
Well, guess who wrote that one? And it was done originally by an eminently successful black vocal group, The Clovers.
Oh!
And so now we're going to hear The Clovers doing Your Cash Ain't Nothing But Trash.
Walking down the main track one night, I met a fine chick, Bill. She stopped when I passed my road. I told her she could have all of my gold. She turned around and with a frown said, this ain't no circus and I don't need a clown. Your cash ain't nothing but trash. Your cash ain't nothing but trash. Your cash ain't nothing but trash. So it ain't no need your hanging around just to make a hit with that chick. I tried to get a Cadillac right quick. The man at the place looked so strange. At $900 and some change, we disagreed. I tried to plead. He said, I ain't a chicken and I don't need your feed. Your cash ain't nothing but trash. Your cash ain't nothing but trash. Your cash ain't nothing but trash. Baby, you're crawling way past your speed. Da 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 da. Said, hands up. I tried to get away, but too slow. He conked me and took all of my dough.
Da-da-da-da.
I heard him shout
da-da-da-da
as he cut out.
Da-da-da-da.
You ain't lost nothing worth the crying about. Your cash ain't nothing but trash. Your cash ain't nothing but trash. Your cash ain't nothing but trash. And he took my watch and I passed out. I woke up in the arms of a big cop. Police station, a next stop. The judge swung his fist down, plunk, plunk. $20 fine cause you're drunk.
Da-da-da-da.
Dig up the dough,
da-da-da-da,
and you can go.
Da-da-da-da.
All I had was a buffalo. Your cash ain't nothing but trash. Your cash ain't nothing but trash. Your cash ain't nothing but trash. But I'm sure gonna get me some more.
I wish I had some cash. These days, I got mostly trash.
I love the Clovers.
The Clovers.
The Clovers are boss.
They were the bomb diggity in the early 50s through the mid-50s. I guess their most famous song would have been Love Potion Number 9,
yeah.
The original version of that,
yeah.
That the Searchers did. But, what we try to do on Rock House is revive some of the names that people have forgotten about, what you might call the unsung forgotten heroes of rock and roll music.
And people who like to split hairs will make the distinction between a rhythm and blues vocal group and a doo-wop group, okay? And the Clovers, they were a vocal group. They weren't quite the shoo-whoop, shoo-whoop, doo-wop, doo-wop type group.
Well, I'll flip this over so people can see right now, I don't have that many hairs left to split. So, I'm not into splitting hairs at all.
That's right.
But what we're doing tonight is celebrating the legacy of a couple of more or less forgotten black musicians from Kansas, Jesse Stone and Maxwell Davis. Davis, a saxophone player from Independence, and Jesse Stone, an all-around guy who did arranging, who did band leading, who figured very prominently in the early history of Atlantic Records. And both of these guys helped lay the foundation which would later become known as rock and roll music. And one thing that's always baffled me living in Kansas like I do is why no one has ever thought to create some kind of fitting memorial for either one of these two guys. Because, you know, a lot of people, with a lot of justification when it comes to black history, a lot of people talk about Langston Hughes, the poet, the writer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, uh-huh. I would submit to you that Maxwell Davis and Jesse Stone, both in their own way, are every bit as important to the overall culture as Langston Hughes. Just not literary figures, but musical figures.
In their own respective yeah. art, you know.
And Big Joe Turner gets some props. He's pretty well known.
Oh, absolutely. And see, he was from Kansas City, Missouri, you know.
Right.
So,
which
you know.
Now, thanks to our president, is actually
it's in Kansas
City. It's Kansas. we got the whole city. Now on the same place.
Hey, I can't.
You guys in Missouri, you're ours.
I can't blame people.
We own you.
I can't blame people for the confusion. I mean, consider this. We have two cities.
Well, it's not called Missouri City.
Well, I mean.
Yeah, right. I mean, it's very confusing.
Bear this out. There's two cities with the same name. They're called Kansas City, Kansas, and Kansas City, Missouri, and both have the name.
You mean Kansas City, Missouri.
Missouri, yeah. And both have the name of a state in it. Kansas. So if you're not from around this area, I can understand that.
I
you
get
know?
That, yeah.
I'll cut people some slack on
you
that.
You got to. Yeah.
In fact, I always get riled up whenever I read that Patsy Cline's final concert was in Kansas City, Missouri. No, it was in Kansas City, Kansas at Memorial Hall.
It was it was a benefit for a KCKN DJ.
Exactly.
An AM country station.
Yep. But we digress.
Yeah, we do. Yeah. Now, yeah. Well, I mean, we can't get much further off the track. The only way we could get further off the track would be to play something by Hawkshaw Hawkins, who also died in the plane crash.
And who is also fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
Utterly amazing.
Awesome. Yeah.
Oh, man. Don't get me started. That's another
too
program.
Too late. We've already started. Too late.
Well, let's listen to Maxwell Davis. This record just came out.
You want to hand me that CD? Where is it?
Yeah, while you're okay. Queuing it up, I'll read that it was originally okay. called the Bop Hop. But it's the Bop Hop, and that's track number 5, by the way. And it says here that a West Coast DJ named Joe Adams began featuring the tune extensively on his radio show. For the next pressing, they retitled it the Adams Bop Hop to show appreciation to DJ Joe Adams.
Okay, yeah, we gotta show some love for these DJs.
Yeah.
Back then, it really meant something to be a DJ.
Yeah. And then maybe when we're done with that, we could segue into some more Elmore James with the tune Standing at the Crossroads.
Oh, okay. Would this be the same Crossroads that Robert Johnson is associated with?
It's more of a slightly modernized version.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, right now, we're going to hit it with Maxwell Davis.
Yep, with the Adams Bop Hop.
The Adams Bop Hop, and then we're going to go right into some Elmore Jones.
Down.
they'll do when you're Elmore. They'll go out with another man, and then you're just standing at the crossroads thinking about your life and how much it sucks.
Let's run down the names of the band you're hearing there.
They just blocked my video.
Oh, they did?
Yeah.
Oh, too bad.
You scumbags.
Well, at any rate, these Elmore James tunes that we're hearing tonight, they were cut in May 1955 at the Modern Labels studio in Culver City, California. And we've got the personnel here. This is the Maxwell Davis Band with James Parr on trumpet, Maxwell Davis on tenor sax, Jewel Grant on baritone sax, Willard McDaniel on piano, Chuck Hamilton bass, and Jesse Sales on drums. All these sides were released on the Flare subsidiary of Modern Records during that same year. And that was the final recording session that Elmore James had for the Modern label. After that, he was recording more in Chicago, like for the Chess label and the VJ label.
Oh, and then Bobby Robinson, who owned the Fire label.
Yes, those wonderful. Those are the only stereo recordings ever made of Elmore James, and they were the last ones he ever made. And he recorded enough for with Bobby Robinson to fill up two LPs. That's amazing stuff.
Yeah, Bobby Robinson hunted him down.
Yeah,
he was a man with a mission, and he said he found Elmore James playing in a basement nightclub with just a hand-lettered cardboard sign in front of it saying, Elmore James tonight. And
I had a guided tour of the Apollo Theater in New York City in 1990, and I did not know at the time that Bobby Robinson's record shop was just right around the corner.
Oh, no.
And had I known that, I would have insisted that we go there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Boy. Yeah, well, at least you saw Muddy Waters in 1977.
Yeah, I've seen Muddy four times around here. But that would have been something to watch Bobby Robinson holding court in his record shop there just around from the corner from the Apollo.
Yeah, you bet. I got to start up my Facebook Live feed again. Okay. I think it's back. Yeah, they blew me off because we were playing some copyrighted material, I guess.
Yeah, that's owned by some major label, the master tapes of which may have gone up in a fire somewhere. Well, let me talk a little bit about what we're going to hear next by B.B. King. It says, by now, Maxwell Davis was arranging sessions. Recalls Joe Bihari of the Modern label, the first one that Maxwell did was Every Day I Have the Blues, and that's the song you're going to hear next. The one we did at the old Capitol Studios. Maxwell had been in Florida, where Louis Jordan has lost his entire book of arrangements. You know, it was due to a bus crash, and all of the written arrangements for all of the tunes were destroyed in that wreck. And
for Louis Jordan?
For Louis Jordan.
Oh,
So he called Maxwell to rearrange all the songs, and when he came back, someone rammed Maxwell's car head on. He was okay, but was in the hospital for a while. Not good for a black man in Georgia. It wasn't his fault, but he was all cut up. He needed a job. That's when I hired Maxwell. We had used him before, but the arrangements for Gene Phillips in the late 40s. He did a lot of Amos Milburn things for Aladdin, played on Ray Anthony's song Idaho on Capitol in 1952. He had a very definite sound with the saxophone, a big, great sound, very fine musician, and a wonderful man, wonderful family man. The value of Maxwell Davis to B.B. King and the Bihari organization cannot be overstated. Says B.B., he was so good at writing, so good. I don't think I've ever met anybody who could write a blues like Maxwell Davis before and since. He was unknown outside the industry, but he made a lot of records for a lot of people.
From Independence, Kansas, Maxwell Davis, here he is. No, wait. Well, yeah.
Yeah, backing up B.B. King with Every Day.
Every day I I prepare a collection of cherished family recipes passed through generations.
Watch Recipes for Disaster at foodsafety.gov. You'll learn the right steps as Maria does everything wrong. Brought to you by the USDA, HHS, and the Ad Council.
At highway speeds, the average text takes your eyes off the road for about 5 seconds. That's enough time to travel the length of a football field. Stop texts. StopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Your favorite tunes of the past. This is Oldies 104, Topeka.
Continuing with the Rock House tribute to Maxwell Davis, Jesse Stone, and Big Joe, Big Joe Turner.
Get out of that bed, wash your face and hands. Get out of that bed, wash your face and hands. Well, you get in that kitchen, make some noise with the pots and pans. Shining through. Well, you wear old dresses, sun comes shining through. I can't believe my eyes, all of this belongs to you. I believe to the soul you know it now. I believe to the soul you a devil in now. I know. Well, all I work the best of my money.
Jesse Stone had a signature tune that would be that one, Shake, Rattle, and Roll, under the nom de plume Charles Calhoun, who was actually some kind of a home builder. The real Charles Calhoun was some kind of a home building cat in Long Island, I think.
Okay.
And I think he'd been building a house for Jesse Stone.
And, I didn't know that.
And Jesse had his reasons, I believe tax-related, for not wanting to have these songs going out under his real name.
Ah, okay.
So he picked the name Charles Calhoun.
Well, see, Jesse Stone's a catchy-sounding name by itself.
In and of itself.
You know?
Yeah. Shake, Rattle, and Roll, there's some contradictory information about that. It looks like, according to the session notes from February 15th of 1954, that Jesse Stone himself, in addition to arranging it, in addition to writing it, played the piano on it. Now, sometimes you'll hear that Van the Piano Man Walls played piano on that.
Yeah.
And I guess you kind of had to be there to know for sure who it was. They're saying that it was Sam the Man Taylor on on tenor sax, which was a big contribution to the sound of the original Shake, Rattle, and Roll.
Yeah.
Along with jazz legend Mickey Baker on guitar.
Absolutely.
Now, speaking of jazz legends, isn't it kind of interesting that technically three of the most highly renowned saxophone players of all time came from Kansas? In other words, Charlie Parker was actually born in Kansas City, Kansas.
Grew up there, too.
And he, of course, cut his teeth in, over on the Missouri side.
Yeah, at the clubs.
In the clubs in the 18th and Vine area.
Yeah.
And was then Big J. McShann took Charlie to New York, and that's where he stayed.
Yeah.
Pretty much from that day on. But you had Charlie Parker, then you had, from the Topeka area, allegedly, you had Coleman Hawkins.
Coleman Hawkins, right, yeah.
And St. Joseph also claims a piece of the Coleman Hawkins legacy.
That's right.
Yeah. But no, St. Joe, you can't have him. And then Maxwell Davis.
Yeah.
A man that we're paying homage to tonight.
And what we've played already tonight just should illustrate the incredible talents of Maxwell Davis on the tenor saxophone. A nice, big, powerful, throaty tone on his tenor.
As we're about to hear in Band 10, which is what?
This one was going to be, oh, let's see, our next one. That's Bristol Drive, this one is, by Maxwell Davis.
Now, these are... Are these not tunes that were released under Maxwell Davis's own personal name?
Yeah, in his first disc in these set, these songs are all tunes that were released under Maxwell's name, and there's some various, they vary a bit with the name of the band backing him up on it, but these are definitely Maxwell Davis front and center playing the tenor sax.
Well, I noticed he's got, on the set, I'm just now looking at the titles on the back, we got a guy named Big Speed McDaniels.
Yeah.
We got to hear from that guy. We got Joe Turner, Don't Talk Me to Death.
Yep.
We got to hear that. And then they've got someone called Geechee Smith doing the T-Town Jump.
Yep.
This has some pretty cool stuff on it.
And there's some Gatemouth Brown on there, too.
I see that. Yep. Gatemouth Brown.
Jimmy Witherspoon. You know, actually, I didn't pick a lot of those tracks of him accompanying others on discs 2 and 3 because quite a few of those tracks are good, but there's not very many that I would call great. And I actually enjoy listening to Maxwell's own tunes on disc 1 than I do him accompanying the other people on discs 2 and 3 on that CD set you've got there. You know, some of that stuff looks pretty interesting. Some of it's kind of pedestrian.
Well, and I'm also noticing that the last track on CD 3 is Little Willie Littlefield's original Kansas City.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We got to hear that.
Okay. We'll play that.
That's Maxwell Davis?
Yeah.
Wow. I never knew that.
Yeah.
That he was the sax player on that. And then you got Clarence Bonton Garlow.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Hurt. So we've discovered another Clarence Bonton Garlow track, which we got to play that too.
Okay.
But we're not going to play anything unless we start playing some more things and quit talking. As Joe Turner would say, don't talk it to death. Here's Maxwell Davis.
Thank you.
So now I'm wondering, is there an actual Bristol Drive in the L.A. area?
I hope so. I hope so.
As opposed to Mulholland Drive.
Yeah.
Or what's the other one?
There's Wilshire Boulevard. You know, there's all kinds of famous streets.
Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah, Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah.
Yeah. Central Avenue.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we're cruising the boulevard tonight on Rock House with... what was the title of that one again?
Bristol Drive.
Bristol Drive, okay.
And I don't think they were talking about Bristol, Tennessee either.
Probably not the Bristol Stomp either.
Yeah, no.
Okay, so now we're gonna shift gears. We had a request, which I'm going to play because we do take requests, even when the tune being requested does not necessarily dovetail with what we're doing on the show. That's okay. Whenever someone actually puts up with the show and listens to the show, if they want to make a request, I'll try to play the request. So, we're going to do, yes, Spanky and Our Gang. Sunday will never be the same. We are going to do that, but before we do Spanky and Our Gang, we're going to hear from another guy that we haven't heard from for a while, and that's Del Shannon.
Del Shannon, this is amazing. Here's a song that Del recorded in London in October 1963. Three songs were recorded that day, Give Her Lots of Lovin' and Time of the Day, both of which were released, and Time of the Day is a Del Shannon masterpiece. But that third song they recorded that day was called Flat Number 3. And you know, in England, a flat is what we call an apartment. So like Apartment Number 3. This tape was set aside, forgotten, abandoned, and just a few years ago, the master tape to this song actually wound up on eBay.
Oh, no.
On eBay. And it fell into the right hands. And so now we have this wonderful compilation LP of Del Shannon that was put out by the guy who founded the Bear Family label, Richard Wise. The name of the label is the Richard Wise Archives. And we're going to hear that long... Yeah, that long-lost Del Shannon song that even the most diehard fans never heard of.
I thought that RWA stood for Rich Kids with Attitude.
Yeah. Yeah. So we'll get to hear then this long-lost and forgotten song, which is really pretty good, by Del Shannon, called Flat Number 3.
And after that, Spanky and Our Gang. Get ready to be Spanky.
There's a place in town, I'm gonna take you around, where they dance all night and day. You don't need a ticket, everything is free. Come along to Flat Number 3. They play the music loud, and there's always a crowd. You ain't got nothing to lose. The landlord's gone and I've got the key. Come along to Flat Number 3.
Come along to Flat Number 3. flocks of pigeons. I remember sunshine and you were mine.
From Bloomington, Illinois, Spanky and our gang. That's our pop spotlight for this evening. Sunday will never be the same. Well, Sunday was never the same after Kris Kristofferson wrote and Johnny Cash sang Sunday Morning Coming Down.
Yeah.
That kind of made me give up on Sunday.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
That's for a friend up in Michigan, Matt. And Michigan happens to be where Del Shannon came from, right?
That's right. He was from Coopersville, which is near Grand Rapids. We went up there for a Del Shannon fan gathering in 1996 and got to meet Del's first wife, his sons and daughters, Max Crook, the guy who played those amazing keyboard parts on there. He and his wife were there up from New Mexico, and the guy who compiled and wrote the liner notes to this album, Brian Young, who's just the most tireless Del Shannon fan in the entire world. He's in Tacoma, Washington. So thank you all very much for letting us be able to hear flat number 3, a long-lost forgotten song by Del Shannon.
Well, Del Shannon played at a place in Topeka called the Southwest Pub.
Yes, and I regret that I wasn't a Del Shannon fan yet. I remember halfway through that week-long gig that Del played there, that Louie did a 30-minute interview with him on KTWU television during primetime.
Oh, my God.
And
live?
Yeah,
oh, wow.
And I have bugged them about a videotape of that, and they say their video archive doesn't go back that far. This was about 1975, but this was midway through their week-long gig there, and they were showing still photographs from the gig out there at the Southwest Pub.
Uh-huh.
And by golly, there was Del Shannon doing a half-hour television interview here in Topeka, and I wish to God that program still existed.
Yeah, that'd be really great to get that.
Yeah.
That'd be right up there with the Del Lowry, Buddy Holly interview.
Recording of Buddy Holly here in Topeka, yeah.
A friend of mine went to see Del at the Southwest Pub during that week. I, alas, did not go. I was doing night radio at the time, so I couldn't go, really.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had the 7 to midnight shift on Big Kiwi.
That's right.
Which pretty well knocked me out of the box as far as going to see. And the owners of the club were really nice people, Chet and Carol Harvey. They did a lot for the Topeka nightlife scene in the 70s.
Years ago, I tried to contact them about photographs of Del at that club, and I never got a response.
I'm not sure if either one of them is still alive.
Yeah.
I know Chet died,
yeah,
and I'm not sure about Carol. But I wish I'd known you were doing that, because I did know them pretty well at the time. Anyway, my friend who saw him, and I'll keep my friend's name out of it, but he said that he had a few drinks with Del Shannon after one of the shows, and that Del was just a great guy.
Yeah.
Just one of the coolest, nicest people you'd ever want to meet. And the reason I don't mention the name of my friend is because he took his own life. And strangely enough, so did Del Shannon.
So did Del Shannon, yeah.
So two guys having drinks in Topeka, Kansas, late, what was that, 75?
Yeah, thereabouts, yeah.
Yeah. And a few years later, they're both gone.
Wow, wow, the great Del Shannon.
Permanent solution to a temporary problem.
Yep.
Is what they call it. Anyway, let's, I want to play one more Del Shannon. I noticed he had a version of From Me to You.
Well, let me tell you the story on that one. Del Shannon holds the distinction of being the first American recording artist to ever record a Lennon and McCartney composition.
No way.
In 1963, the Beatles were the warm-up act for Roy Orbison on a British tour, and later that year, they were the warm-up act for Del Shannon on a British tour. And they played...
The Beatles warmed up Del Shannon.
That's right. And so they played from Me to You, and Del famously in numerous interviews says, you know, I'm going to go back to the States and record that song From Me to You. And they kind of nodded their heads in approval, and then they were about to walk onto the stage, and all of a sudden John Lennon turns around and points to Del and he says, don't do that. Don't do that. Because I think John thought better of it and thought, gee, we want to break into America without anybody already knowing our songs. But Del went ahead and did record and release From Me to You, a good 6 months or so before the Beatles finally arrived in the United States.
Yeah, that really... That just crushed their plans for becoming big in the
United States. For world domination, you know.
All right, well, here it is. The Del Shannon rendition of From Me to You. That's pretty good.
Yeah. And another story connecting...
Del Shannon, everybody.
Connecting this song, Del Shannon and the Beatles. George Harrison's sister, Louise, at a very young age, married an American and moved to Southern Illinois. This was in the early 1960s. And in fact, in 1963, George and his brother came to visit his sister in Southern Illinois and actually got to walk the streets of American as a complete unknown. Okay, and so he had a lot to report when he went back to England to tell the other three Beatles. Well, his sister, George's sister Louise would do anything to help her brother and his band.
Yeah.
And so she had a British 45 then that George brought of From Me to You. And she took that around to radio stations in St. Louis and Southern Illinois to try to get some airplay for it. And she received in return a letter from a program director of a station in St. Louis, I believe it was, who thanked her for the record but says, I don't think we're going to be playing that because we're already playing that song on the 45 by Del Shannon.
Oh, no.
So, and that letter still exists and has been published to this day. So Del's version was getting some airplay there within earshot of George Harrison's sister Louise, who lived east of St. Louis back in 1963.
Well, and that would almost vindicate John Lennon's feeling that,
yeah,
you're going to destroy us.
That's right.
You're going to ruin us in America. Don't do that.
Right.
I wonder what station that was. There was a rock station, KXOK.
In St. Louis?
St. Louis.
Yeah, that was, yeah.
they were the big rock station.
Yeah.
But there could have been others. WIL, maybe, I'm not sure.
Yeah. But that's a couple of pretty interesting stories about Del Shannon's connection with the Beatles.
Well, now, he went to New York and did some recording with some pretty interesting people, including Bucky Pizzarelli
yes,
on the guitar.
Yes,
yes. As well as, yeah, this would have been in the, it says the Bell Sound Studio.
Yeah, he recorded a lot at Bell Sound, yeah.
Now, From Me to You, I think, might have been recorded in Portland, or...
oh, dear.
Let's see. Portland Place? The IBC Studio?
Oh, that's in London also.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the IBC Studios. That was London.
So
yeah.
Maybe he did that. It says here that Johnny Tillotson attended that session.
Wow.
Who knows? Maybe Johnny Tillotson sang backup.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to get... What we're going to get back to now, we had a Del Shannon interlude with a Spanky and our gang... surrealistic pop interlude
by request.
Yeah, and we will take your request. By the way, you can text me at 785-969-4986, just like Matt did, or you can call 969-4986. That's area code 785. You can send me an email, marshallbarber@hotmail.com, or you can even call the Bill Black phone in the Oldies 104.net studio, 785-350-6239, an actual rotary dial black phone, which we've named the Bill Black phone in honor of Elvis's first bass player. So, yeah, well, you want to hear something? We'll give it a shot for you.
Hey, I've got an idea here.
What's your idea?
We have one of Link Ray's daughters listening to us right now.
Really?
Mona Tidwell.
Mona!
Yes, and I have here with me a Del Shannon song that sounds just like Link Ray at his most terrifying. Do
yeah?
you think now would be the time to play that if Mona Tidwell is listening?
Why not?
Let's do that. Hang on, I'll pull it out.
Hey, whatever we can do for Mona, we're not just doing it for Mona.
Yeah.
We're doing it for all the Link Ray fans out there and for the human race in general.
Okay, cue up number 7 on that one.
Let me do that.
The story on this one is... that Del Shannon had a session again in October of 1963, and I'll need to refer to that booklet to talk about that. And I don't know what was
going on. Track 7?
Yeah, track 7. It's called...
there you go.
Yeah, called Torture. Now, the deal is...
Torture?
Yeah.
You want to torture Mona?
Yeah.
What kind of guy are you?
Well, let's just go ahead and play it, and then we'll explain ourselves out. This one's for you.
Yeah, you got a lot of explaining to do.
That's right. This one's going out for Mona Tidwell. If this doesn't sound like Link Ray, you tell me, okay?
Okay. Here it is, Mona.
In the 16th century, the thing men feared most was the torture chamber. Oh,
Yeah, how about that for a Del Shannon song, huh?
That's a little over the top.
Yeah, it really is. That was October 1963 at United Sound Studio in Detroit. Del Shannon, vocal and rhythm guitar, accompanied by Dick Stanford and the Teen Beats on lead guitar, bass, and drums and saxophone. And there's two other songs they recorded at that same session that were along that same line. They were entitled Nothing and Froggy.
Well, you can sure detect the Link Wray influence.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
That sounded like him.
Yeah.
It sure did. Did Del Shannon and Link Wray ever get together, do you think?
Not that I know of.
Yeah.
Not that I know of, yeah.
Yeah, well.
Maybe in the next time Deke Dickerson records his next Link Wray tribute album under the name of Blind Rage and Violence, he could do a cover of this song on that album.
That's probably a good idea.
Yeah.
I mean, as long as you've tortured Mona.
That's right.
You might as well just subject everybody to the same treatment.
Well, she responded by saying, thanks, y'all, with a smiley and a heart, and then she says, love it.
Good
so
deal.
There you go. We have the approval of Mona Tidwell, daughter of Link Wray.
Hugs for Mona tonight.
That's right.
Okay. Well, now this brings us back to what we had been doing,
yeah,
which was paying homage to Jesse Stone and Maxwell Davis, two of the architects of the early rock and roll sound. And I believe we're ready for some more what?
Elmore James, I believe.
Okay. Oh, well, okay, yeah. We were also playing Elmore James and B.B. King.
Yeah.
Because this Elmore James is Southern California.
That's right. Right. That's right, in L.A.
Recorded on what label?
For the Modern label.
And
its various subsidiaries, RPM, Crown, Kent, and others.
Okay. So do we think that Maxwell Davis played on this?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, this is Maxwell Davis's band backing up Elmore James.
Okay, so here they are, and they're going to do one called Sunnyland.
Yep.
And this gets back to a thesis that we earlier put forth saying the blues sounds just a little happier.
A little brighter.
SoCal blues.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's 2-3 miles away from a beach. Which you might even call Sunnyland. Here it is, Elmore James.
Better change.
Rock House is where you're going to hear Elmore James with Maxwell Davis. Probably the only place you're going to hear that. As we continue to pay homage to a couple of the Kansas colossi of early rhythm and blues and rock and roll. That would be Maxwell Davis, who we heard backing up Elmore there. That would also be Jesse Stone, who we're going to hear from next. Now, Jesse Stone, you're not going to hear him. Who you're going to hear is Ray Charles. We got one here that not one of Ray's better known efforts, but fairly typical of what was being done on the Atlantic label at the time he recorded this. And this is another one. Mark's talked about this, where Jesse Stone was credited as being the arranger, meaning he did what?
He writes out the sheet music for each individual instrument heard in the song.
And was a big player. In fact, I think he told Nick Toshis, you've read the same chapter in the same book that I've read. Tell me if I'm remembering this wrong. I think he told Nick Toshis that his involvement with Atlantic in the early 50s ended because he wanted to buy a piece of it. And they wouldn't sell it to him.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I recall that. Yeah, he wanted a share in the company.
Yeah. And that never happened, so...
And, you know, originally it was, I think it was three or four ways between Ahmet Erdogan, Jerry Wexler, and...
Oh, yeah, the dentist.
And Herb Abramson.
Herb Abramson.
Herb Abramson. And,
yeah.
And maybe Neshui Erdogan, Ahmet's brother. He may have been a partner in the company, too.
Right. Okay. So here's one from Ray Charles that Jesse Stone arranged called The Midnight Hour, not to be confused with the Wilson Pickett concept of The Midnight Hour. Here it is.
The midnight hour have found me lonely, so unhappy as I can be. You left me, yes, you left me without a love. Gave you my loving, everything I own. That's why it's so shocking to find you gone. It's kidding me, it's hard to be without a love. Now since you know when, the way it's got me, baby, you know it's a sin. I haven't got no money and I've lost my friend, all because I fell for you. I don't know why to worry when you left me in a hurry. You're gone and I'm alone without a follow you most anywhere, but now you're gone and I'm alone without a love.
That was done a few years before Ray Charles became very well known in America. That was from September of 1952. Actually recorded on September 11th of 1952. 9/11 in New York in 1952 was a good day, because that was the day that Ray Charles got together with Sam Taylor on sax, Mickey Baker on guitar, Dave McRae on sax, Connie Kay on drums, and in an arrangement by Jesse Stone recorded, The Midnight Hour. There's one that's got a real intensity of feeling behind it there.
Yeah.
We've got another Jesse Stone classic coming up. A couple of these are tunes that you don't hear so much about these days, but were examples of early Atlantic recordings that helped put the company on the map. But before we do that, we have some more.
B.B. King. This one's called Did You Ever Love a Woman? And the liner notes here, it says that this song was a vehicle for Maxwell Davis's stellar little band as much as it was for B.B. For the greater part, B.B. lays back, leaving most of the fills to pianist Willard McDaniel. The song was based on sometime WDIA radio disc jockey Gatemouth Moore's 1945 version for the National label. Its rhetorical lyrics invoked excited responses from the audiences in his early days. Well, Gatemouth Moore was also from Topeka, as we recall.
What?
Yeah.
I forgot that.
That's right.
Gatemouth Moore.
Yeah. He recorded extensively for the King label.
Okay.
And he was originally from Topeka. And like I said, he was a sometimes disc jockey in Memphis on WDIA.
So how do we find more of his recordings?
Oh, I've got a CD of those at home. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Better bring him in. He's not one of my favorites, but I'll bring him in since he's from our hometown here.
Sure. Sure. Yeah, we got to get down with the Gatemouth.
That's right.
Hell yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
But this is B.B. King from 1956 with Did You Ever Love a Woman, with Maxwell Davis and his band.
There's Maxwell right there.
Yep.
Did you ever love a woman? And you loved her with all your might. Fix a breakfast in the morning, stay at home every day, even wash the dishes if she have to go away. You send the children to school, even mend the hose, stay up all nights with the babies, even wash their dirty clothes. But when it's time to go to bed, the woman grabs you in her arm. She holds you real tight. She hugs you with all her charm. She calls you a lot of sweet names. Then she turns out the light. She sets your soul on fire. And you say, baby, everything's all right. Did you ever love a woman? And you thank you.
That's not for beginners.
That's right.
1956?
Yep.
Okay.
Nice piano on that one. Hi, Dan Kingman. He's a local real estate mogul. And Brett Allen O'Neill, progressive agenda activist. Thank you all for tuning in and listening tonight.
You betcha. Dan's a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm temporarily off Facebook. I'm trying to conserve batteries. My battery kind of got low.
Ah, okay.
But so I'm not doing Facebook Live right now. But okay. I'm going to come back. We're flipping this one over, and getting back into some Jesse Stone directed material on Atlantic, and this is another one of his contributions from a group that's not well known today. There was a group called the Mellotones, and they were signed by Atlantic in 1951, but you won't find any recordings by the Mellotones on Atlantic. You will find recordings by a group called the Cardinals. They were renamed the Cardinals after signing with Atlantic. And this was another Baltimore group. They were auditioned, in fact, at the Super Music Record Shop in Baltimore. Auditioned for Ahmet Ertegun and Herb Abramson, who had been hipped to the group by their manager, a guy named Sam Azrael, who owned the store in Baltimore. And at the first session for the Cardinals at the Apex Studios in March of 1951, it was supervised by Jesse Stone.
There we go.
Who coached the group into the desired R&B sound. And the result was a tune called Shouldn't I Know, which appeared on the charts on my first birthday, October 6th. 1951.
There we go.
So there's a special place in my heart for that one.
Yep.
And the Cardinals, it goes on to say, only had 12 singles, period, on Atlantic during their six-year stint at the label. Two of their more notable offerings were The Door Is Still Open, which was covered by Dino later, and Wheel of Fortune, which was a real popular song recorded by a lot of people, including K-Star.
Yeah.
But a more awesome version, modern version, done by the inimitable Luann Barton and Jimmy Vaughn.
Yeah, and Robert Gordon has a great version of that one, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, he does.
So, anyway, here's the Cardinals from 1951 doing Shouldn't I Know.
Shouldn't I Know.
For long, on the lonely night.
couldn't I know.
Rock House resurrects the Cardinals.
Hitting a high note there
Shouldn't
at the
I
end.
Know. Yeah, when they say sings like a bird, well, yeah, sings like the Cardinals. And there's a group that never got the popularity that they deserved. Who knows why? They remind me a little bit of, just because they came from the same general neck of the woods, they remind me a little bit of the Clovers.
Yeah.
Who were also from the Baltimore, Washington area. And that's near and dear to my heart because that's where my dad was a rock and roll DJ in the early days of rock and roll on WITH in Baltimore, Maryland. And they played on that station. They played the Clovers and the Cardinals and everybody else back in those days. And there's a guy named Buddy Dean who was kind of the big boss jock there for a long time. And that would be a song that John Waters might have grown up listening to. Although, since it came out in 1951 and didn't linger around too long, it would have been one of those songs that would have been played on the black stations if there was one in Baltimore, and I'm sure there was.
Oh, I'm sure. The Baltimore, D.C. area.
And a lot of jukeboxes, probably. But doubt if it ever got heard on. Of course, this was before they even had Top 40 radio.
Right.
So
back then, it was like a radio station would have one rock and roll DJ, and he would actually pay for his airtime. He would get the records. He would bring the people on to interview. He would sell the airtime. He would promote the concerts and sell tickets to them. And when it became apparent to the station owners that this guy was making more money than anybody on the station, you know, they made some big changes by the end of the decade.
Yeah, and originally, that guy would have had like 7 to 9 p.m. on Tuesdays or something.
Yeah, right.
All right. So there's a little bit about Jesse Stone. Lived to be 98 years old. And I guess the pseudonym Charles Calhoun actually had more to do with conflict with the membership of the Music Licensing Society.
Ah, okay.
Is what this download that you printed off shows. That this was actually the wily Ahmet Ertegun counseling Stone to use the pseudonym of Charles Calhoun, an unknowing local builder, on his BMI tunes to avoid conflict with his membership and the other Music Licensing Society.
Oh,
asking.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's what that was all about.
Yeah, as a songwriter, you'd be under contract with a publishing company that was the collection agency would either be BMI or ASCAP, and you just didn't work for both. You know
exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll come back to Jesse in just a minute. We have someone you may or may not suspect would have been recording a Jesse Stone song. But before we do that, we got some more Muddy Waters.
Yeah, let's go back to Muddy Waters' final albums in the late 1970s and early 80s. The second album that he had on the Blue Sky label was called I'm Ready. And this is my favorite of the four Muddy Waters albums on Blue Sky Columbia. On this album, Muddy is reunited with Jimmy Rogers, who played rhythm guitar for Muddy for nearly a decade in the 1950s. He's noted for his gritty tone, and it's heard to really good effect on this album. And also, Big Walter Horton plays harmonica on this album, as you'll hear on this tune coming up. We got to see Jimmy Rogers play in the early 1980s in Kansas City at a pre-Grand Emporium blues nightclub they had back then called King Henry's Feast. Now, the particular Jimmy Rogers was there, and he had Carrie Bell on harmonica, and he even had Taylor. He had Hound Dog Taylor's drummer with him, Ted Harvey.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that was really quite a night. It was 100 degrees that day, the air conditioning was broke, and literally there were mice crawling up our legs under the tables in that nightclub. You could feel what felt like moths or something flying around down underneath around our legs, but no, these were mice crawling up our legs, and every now and then you'd see somebody whisking and brushing their legs off because the mice were running up their legs. That was truly a blues club. That was.
That's a real blues experience.
Yeah.
All right. So we're going to hear Muddy Waters.
Muddy Waters, and he's doing the song Screaming and Crying.
Thank you.
Making America groovy again. It's Rock House on oldies104.net, getting down with Muddy. What's the name of that one?
That was called Screaming and Crying from his album I'm Ready, which came out in 1978.
And you say this was in 1977 that you saw him?
I saw Muddy Waters four times, and that one ticket stub I showed you was 1977 at the Uptown Theater, yeah.
Oh, okay, so that would have been a more civilized venue.
Yeah.
Than the one you were talking about with the mice crawling up your leg.
Yeah, that was Jimmy Rogers, Muddy Waters' rhythm guitar player. He did his own show at King Henry's Feast around 1981 or 82, that was.
King Henry's Feast, also known as the Mouse House.
That's right.
Okay. You know, I saw Muddy Waters so long ago that I barely remember much of it, which could be perhaps attributable to the cereal malt brewski content of the evening. As well as some other flavors that were popular at the time on the Grinnell College campus. But we had this guy, Gary Giddens, who went on to write some books about jazz. Okay, he was... I think he was a junior when I was a freshman.
Oh, man.
But and anyway, he was in charge of bringing in the music.
Ah.
And this guy was just really hip.
Yeah.
So he brought in all these awesome people.
Yeah.
Including Muddy Waters.
Yeah.
Because Grinnell wasn't that far from Chicago.
Yeah, you're not far from Chicago anyway. You know? Yeah.
He brought in Duke Ellington.
Yeah.
Which was somewhat controversial. You know, Duke Ellington and... Jesse Stone worked together a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It says here that the Duke got Stone's orchestra booked at the Cotton Club in 1936, and that Ellington even put Stone up free of charge in his apartment for 4 months.
Wow.
While Stone was working as a band leader at the Apollo, the same Apollo which Daddy O'Dilly has visited.
That's right.
So this is all kind of interesting, but Duke Ellington played at Grinnell in the fall of 1968 at the behest of Gary Giddens, who also brought a number of great blues performers and made it possible for idiots like me to see some of these guys.
And stay up too late.
Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah. If I had that one to do over again, I'd quit drinking for 2 weeks before that show. And maybe brought a little tape recorder or something. But, these guys would come in and they were doing the same thing there that they were doing in Chicago, and they were out in the middle of a cornfield going, well, how do we get out here anyway?
That's right.
But they liked it because the audiences were so enthusiastic.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't quite understanding where all of the idolatry was coming from.
Yeah. We had the same scene going on in Lawrence at the time too.
Exactly.
We really did. And Kansas City. Kansas City. Yeah.
Right.
Same thing. Yeah.
Okay, so there's our Muddy Waters for tonight. We still have more Maxwell Davis and more Jesse Stone coming up. And what's our next Maxwell Davis?
Well, this one's called Resistor.
Okay. And we're going to do this as we roll into the third hour, third and final hour, tonight's edition of Rockcast.
My name is Mira. Many families have come to America for a better life. I advocate for these families with United Way to make the community stronger. I don't just wear the shirt. I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer. Live United. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
There's no place like home.
Getting home safely is just a click away. Find the right seat for your little one's age and size. Visit safercar.gov/the right seat for more information. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Oldies 104, Topeka.
I'm going to Kansas City. Kansas City, here I come. I'm going to Kansas City. Kansas City, here I come. They got a crazy way of loving there, and I'm gonna get me some. I'm gonna be standing on the corner, 12th Street and Vine. I'm gonna be standing on the corner, 12th Street and Vine. With my Kansas City baby and a bottle of Kansas City wine. Well, I might take a train, I might take a plane, but if I have to walk, I'm going just the same. I'm going to Kansas City, here I come. They got a crazy way of loving there, and I'm gonna get myself. Hard much. My clothes, leave at the crack of dawn. I'm going to pack my clothes, leave at the crack of dawn. My old lady will be sleeping and she won't know where I'm going. 'Cause if I stay with that woman, I know I'm gonna die. Gotta find a brand new baby, and that's the reason why. I'm going to Kansas City, here I come. They got a crazy way of loving there, and I'm gonna get me some. They got a crazy way of loving there, and I'm gonna get me some. They got a crazy way of loving there.
Well, can my lover
perils of pink champagne. Nothing like a little cold duck to transmogrify what was going to be a great night into a nightmare.
I think I heard a baritone tooting there at the very end of that one.
I think you did. There were a number of saxophone players involved there, including Maxwell Davis, but also Willie Jackson and John Jackson on Joe Liggins and his Honey Drippers, Pink Champagne. That was recorded in January of 1950. That was before I was even born.
Mm-hmm.
Not to mention before Daddy O'Dilly was even born.
Yeah, a few years later.
Yeah.
When I was born, I like to say that Hank Williams was barely cold in his grave.
Yeah.
Elvis Presley was working up the gumption to walk into the Sun studio for the first time, and Muddy Waters was the king of the Chicago blues.
There you go.
That's what was happening when I was born in March of 1953.
Oh, and okay. 53, yeah. Well, in 1950, January 20th, I'm trying to think. Maybe. See, I was born October 6, 1950. So when that tune was recorded, my parents might have been thinking about having a kid.
There you go.
They might have been actually getting pretty close to doing the deed, the procreative deed.
That's right.
Because counting back 9 months from the 10th month, that leaves you, what, January 6th?
Yeah.
So I guess I was already going.
Yeah.
Pretty strong.
Want to say hi to Aunt Joanne Edmond and Lawrence.
Yeah.
And fellow retired co-worker Bob Vukas. Thanks for tuning in tonight, folks.
You mentioned Elvis working up the nerve.
The nerve.
Yes.
The gumption.
Right.
The courage.
When he went into the Sun Studios and somebody asked him who he sounded like, and he said, "I don't sound like nobody."
Nobody. Yeah.
But we do have, once again, paying homage to Jesse Stone. Here's a tune that Jesse wrote for the Drifters. Clyde McFadder sang it, but it was subsequently covered by Elvis. Yes, it's Money Honey.
Tell me what was on his mind. He said, "Money, honey, money, honey, money, honey, if you want to get along with me." Well, I screamed and I hollered, I was so hard pressed. I called the woman that I loved the best. I finally got my baby by the 3:30. She said, "I'd like to know what you want with me." I said, "Money, honey, money, honey, money, honey, if you want to get along with me." Another man take my place. She said, "Money, honey, money, honey, money, honey, if you want to get along with me." Well, I've learned a lesson and now I know the sun may shine and the winds may blow, the women may come and the women may go, but before I say I love you. Money, honey, if you wanna get along with me."
It's the Elvis version of Money Honey. A couple of noteworthy musicians appearing on that, which once again was written by Jesse Stone, originally under the nom de plume of Charles Calhoun, but by the time it came out on this Elvis album, they were just going ahead and putting Jesse Stone's name on the label with it. But you not only had Scotty Moore on guitar, you had Chet Atkins on rhythm guitar. This is January of 1956. And, you know, you think of Floyd Kramer as being this sort of Nashville sound guy, Last Date and all that.
Yeah.
Well, that guy could rock out.
Yeah.
He was a serious rock and roll piano player, and no better evidence of that than his session work in Money Honey.
Yeah, he was really pounding that one key real hard over and over again on that one.
Yeah, yeah. He could knock him out of the park every time, Floyd Kramer. So that's our one and only Elvis selection tonight, as a very young Elvis Presley. He was only, 21?
Yeah.
He'd have done that 2 days after his birthday.
Yeah, and in January 56, that would have been the beginning of him with RCA.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And they weren't too sure what they had at first, but it wasn't too long before they knew what they had.
Oh, boy.
With selections like Money Honey.
The reports from the accounting office were very interesting at RCA when the sales of Elvis records started being tallied up.
You know? Yes, indeed. Well, now we're going to get back into paying homage to Maxwell Davis.
That's right.
I don't think he played on any Elvis records, but...
Well, here's a guy who did. When Elvis went to the West Coast, you know, he worked with songwriters Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller.
Oh, yeah.
And I believe it was Mike Stoller who played piano on some Elvis tracks.
Who wrote Kansas City that we heard Little Willie.
Right. Well, here's what Mike Stoller had to say about Maxwell Davis.
Oh.
He said, Maxwell Davis is an unsung hero of early rhythm and blues. He produced, in effect, all the record sessions for Aladdin Records, Modern Records, and all the local independent rhythm and blues companies in the early 1950s and the late 1940s in Los Angeles.
Speaking of Aladdin, I wonder if we should include an Amos Milburn tune here before the end of the show. So, we'll go back, however, to something we already have ready. And this is really interesting in that Elmore James ended up recording with Maxwell Davis.
Yeah, and like I said, it was that one time, and it was his final session with the Modern label. And all of those tracks we have at our fingertips here tonight, and this next one is called Mean and Evil.
Yeah, this would be very typical Elmore James.
Yeah.
Not an upbeat concept here. Okay, here we go, getting mean and evil.
Treat me
Optimus. Elmore James, Mean and Evil. Yeah, we're making America groovy again here on Rock House. Our guest host is Daddy O'Dilly, and we are delving into the legacies of Maxwell Davis and Jesse Stone. And some of these Maxwell Davis performers are pretty well known, Elmore James being a case in point. Little Willie Littlefield, not so much. We heard him at the top of the hour doing the first version of Kansas City, which your friends Lieber and Stoller wrote. Even though they'd never been to Kansas City. Hence the reference to 12th and Vine, when actually there was no 12th and Vine, which we discovered much to our chagrin in 1968 after graduating from high school and almost getting killed looking for 12th and Vine. In 1968, right after the Martin Luther King assassination riots.
Yeah,
good plan, kids. Load up on illegal beer and head for the corner of 12th and Vine. I thought this cop was just going to shoot us.
Wow.
I shouldn't really make a joke about that because, as it turns out, yeah, those police did shoot people.
That's right.
But since we were white kids, I guess that's what got us off the hook that night.
Yeah, but there were certain kind of white kids that, you know, were a favorite target.
Yeah.
Some overenthusiastic law enforcement.
Yeah.
Know, if your hair was too long, you know.
Right, right. Yeah, we were relatively clean-shaven.
Oh, you were?
In those days.
Okay.
Well, we'd just gotten out of high school.
Okay.
And back then, they wouldn't let... I don't want to get too sidetracked into this, you know, reminiscence of the way it was.
Yeah.
But back then, you really did get kicked out of school if your hair was too long.
That's right.
They'd make you go home and cut it.
That's right.
Basically. So, anyway, some of these Maxwell Davis selections, before we got sidetracked into... Little Willie Littlefield's Kansas City, were pretty well known. And some of these where he was just sort of an anonymous session player in the background for people who themselves never became that well known, such as Amos Easton, a.k.a. Bumblebee Slim. Now, with a name like Bumblebee Slim, you're assuming that he's probably a blues guy. But I don't know. We'll find out. This is one called Strange Angel. And when you have a guy who self-applies the name Bumblebee Slim.
Yeah.
And writes a tune called Strange Angel, well, you just got to check it out. Even if Maxwell Davis isn't on it, which he is. Here it is.
Strange angel, how is everything up there? Strange angel, strange angel, how is everything up there? Your gown looks lovely with that long black curly hair. Strange angel, strange angel, sang me a lovely song. Sing me a lovely song. Rock me to sleep in your wings where I belong. If the good Lord answer prayer, if the good Lord answer prayer. Would you trade heaven for a lovely throne down here?
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
There's a forgotten classic.
Yeah.
Strange Angel, Bumblebee Slim, also known as Amos Easton, who wrote the tune. That was recorded for the Specialty label, and that's a good example of how Art Rupee, before Specialty became the big-time rock and roll label, a good example of how Art Rupee would comb the whatever he combed, the waterfront. I'm not sure where he found all these people.
Yeah.
But he spared no effort to get the best musicians into his studio because he was dedicated to producing quality sound. And as pedestrian as that sounds to say, well, quality sound, I mean, he really was all about making the best records that could be made at that time.
Yeah, he was just tapped into the vein in both New Orleans and Los Angeles.
Yeah.
The Specialty label, you know.
So this was August of 1951. And, of course, once again, this is sort of in Nick Tosha's territory where in his book Unsung Heroes of Rock and Roll, he talks about the men and women who are making this music way before Elvis and who never really got the recognition as rock and roll itself became more popular. These guys were, for the most part, eclipsed by the more popular figures in the genre. But yeah, Amos Easton did the vocal work. There was a guy named Willard McDaniel playing that piano.
We were just sitting here flipping out over his incredible... Thank God his piano was mic'd up front in that recording. Imagine if that piano was buried in the mix on that one. But, oh, that was front and center. Just amazing piano playing.
And there's some other people whose names aren't especially well-known these days. Morris Simon, also on alto sax. Jewel Grant on baritone sax. Mitchell Tiny Webb on guitar. William K. Billy Hadnot on bass. And Oscar Lee Bradley on drums, rounding out the session that produced Strange Angel. And they don't have any notes here on how it did. It would appear that it possibly got released, but doesn't seem like it really made much of a dent on the charts at the time. Be kind of cool to have that on vinyl. I've got that on a CD.
Or a 78 back in those days.
Yeah, 78. I bet it did come out on 78.
Oh, at that early time, no doubt. Yeah. No doubt.
There's probably a time that the discerning record buyer could have snapped that one up. Okay, so what are we doing next?
Well, would you like to go then back to the Elmore James then?
Okay, let's do that.
Okay.
Just ahead of some more Clovers.
Now you were commenting about Elmore James' pessimistic song titles. We just played Mean and Evil, but this one on the other side, though, is called Happy Home.
Yeah, let's just see how happy it turns out.
Yeah.
Happy, happy.
You know something going on. $20 bill. Yes, you know I was gonna let's go out and have a good time. And she bought me a Cadillac Seville.
Kind of reminds me of Lefty Frizzell's "If You Got the Money, I Got the Time."
I've got the time. Yeah, there you go. Yeah, that was a sweet little angel.
We'll get your Cadillac, leave my old wreck behind.
Yeah. I think BB would perform that song for till the end of his life, "Sweet Little Angel." And I think maybe later he did. Maybe even better versions than what you heard there. It seemed like maybe some of his guitar playing in there was just a little bit tentative, and I think he perfected that song as time went on. And but again, we have Maxwell Davis's band backing him up, and I want to read something about that. He says here, "By now, Maxwell Davis was arranging sessions, and Joe Bahari of the Modern label says the first one that Maxwell did was Every Day I Have the Blues, the one we did at the old Capitol Studios." I think I read that one already, didn't I? Let's skip that. But I do want to mention that prior to that, on the Elmore James track, once again we heard that incredible Willard McDaniel on the piano. That was just amazing stuff. Just amazing stuff. I had another quote here about Maxwell Davis.
This Willard McDaniel.
Here we go. I've got it now. It says,
By
now, BB was cutting most of his records at Modern with Los Angeles studio musicians under the direction of Maxwell Davis and Joe Bahari. Calvin Owens can recall the orchestra playing one Chicago session. We traveled all the way from Boston to Chicago by bus, and while BB was recording one song, Maxwell Davis and I were writing the arrangements for the next one. So as soon as I got done with one song, they had freshly penned arrangements for the next song at the same session. It says, then we rushed back to Boston to continue the tour. The pace was scorching. George Coleman admired Maxwell Davis. He was an extraordinary musician. Of course, he was playing tenor. I remember Onzi Horn had sent in an arrangement, and Maxwell had transposed the alto part from sight. That's the West Coast influence, he says. Those studio guys could really read good, and he had probably been reading and writing all his life. And he played a couple of solos, too, and played that growling stuff. Maxwell Davis's charts would be used for the shows and on the road. That was about the only influence the record company had on the live shows that Coleman can recall. And so, but it just goes on to say then that he was a valuable member in the studio, writing arrangements and playing saxophone for numerous B.B. King tunes.
Well, all right. No higher praise could be imagined.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, so we are continuing for just a few more moments to pay homage to the legacies of Maxwell Davis and Jesse Stone, the occasion being Black History Month, the place being Kansas, where both guys were born. Jesse Stone in Atchison and Maxwell Davis in Independence.
Yep.
Down there in Montgomery County, where they put people in jail for not paying their medical bills.
Oh, boy. CBS put that story out, and that one got... did you read that or hear that? That started...
I saw it on Facebook.
Well, yeah, and that was part of a story that was on CBS News. You know, the network put that out.
Wow.
And
I did not know it made CBS.
And one response says that there is actually a court session that takes place every week here in Topeka where people who can't pay their medical bills are brought in front of the judge, and that this has been going on for decades. And I'll share that information with you. I'd like to see some investigative journalism reporting on that.
Well, that isn't quite what it seems, in that if you have a medical bill that goes into collection.
Yeah.
It isn't the hospital that takes you to court. It's okay. Their attorney. And the reason why people go to jail it's not the hospital's trying to put them in jail. It's they don't show up. And if you don't show up a couple of times in a row,
right,
then you're looking at a contempt of court.
That's right.
And then you do get arrested.
Yeah.
Now, the question might be, not to veer off too far into this, if some hapless wage earner here in Kansas can get hauled up for contempt of court, then why didn't some of these guys who refused to testify at the impeachment hearings get the same treatment? That's just a question.
Just a
question. Yes. I'm not saying who's right or wrong here.
Yep.
I'm kind of waiting to hear from back east. I think our Massachusetts correspondent wanted to hear some Fabian tonight. So I'm. Okay. Yeah. Our Massachusetts correspondent is listening.
Okay.
So, in spite of the fact that Maxwell Davis and Jesse Stone had absolutely nothing to do with Fabian, if anybody recording Fabian, it would have been a grouchy guy named Bernie Lowe.
Yeah.
On the Chancellor label, there he is with "Turn Me Loose."
Yep.
Muddy Waters coming up next.
I say, this is the first time I ever felt this way. Gonna get a thousand kicks or kiss a thousand chicks. So turn me loose.
This could be a BB King song.
Turn me loose. Turn me loose, I say. Gonna rock and roll as long as the band's gonna play. Gonna holler, gonna shout, I'll knock myself right out. So turn me loose.
Turn me loose.
Oh, I got some change in my pocket and I'm preparing to go. Taking some chicken to the picture show. And when I see you home and we kiss goodnight,
for Peter out in Massachusetts. There's your hound dog, man.
That's right.
Turn me loose. A couple of things here. You were mentioning that your favorite Fabian tune is Tiger.
Yeah.
Well, we actually had a slow pitch softball team named after that song in the early, what was that, 70s. The Tigers. Nothing could stop us. From drinking beer, anyway.
Yeah.
Our softball prowess was kind of tantamount to Fabian's vocal prowess. Yeah. Lots of smoke and mirrors involved in that project. Turn Me Loose was actually a top 10 tune.
Oh,
did
yeah.
You know that?
Yeah.
It was up in to number 9. Now, are you too close? It's my phone that's doing that. There we go. That was me. Okay. Something about these cell phones, if they get too close to the microphone,
mm-hmm. Yep.
It sets up this weird little feedback loop.
Yep.
But yeah, Fabian got up to number 9 with Turn Me Loose and number 3 with Tiger.
Mm-hmm.
And then Hound Dog Man was in the top 10. So 1959 was a pretty big year for old Fabian. And is it any coincidence that, let's see, I guess 50 years later, the Kia Motor Corporation came out with the Kia Forte, Fabian's last name. So whenever you see a Kia Forte on the road, you should Honk for Fabian or something.
That's right.
You know, they should make some bumper stickers for Forte drivers saying, honk if you love Fabian.
Yeah, that's right.
Or honk if you want to turn me loose. Always happy to play that one. But I've got that on the original 45 on the Chancellor label. And I played that a lot on my college radio show, which pretty much reduced to zero any slim chance I might have had of getting a date with anybody. Oh, yeah, you're that drunk guy that plays Fabian all the time.
I don't want to know you.
I don't want to know you. I'm going to go back to my dorm room and smoke some dope and listen to the Jefferson Airplane.
That's right.
Talk about revolution. Yeah, okay. Okay, where were we now? Are we getting ready for... I think I had some more Maxwell Davis.
Well, I think, don't we have Muddy Waters queued up?
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, this is our final Muddy Waters selection. This is the fourth and, this is the live album that Muddy put out.
Right.
So let's play that one.
This is a big one.
Yeah.
For Muddy Waters. It's kind of a signature Muddy Waters tune, isn't it?
Yeah, and Bo Diddley kind of did his version of it, too.
He would.
Oh, yeah. Everything gonna be all right this morning. Oh, yeah. My mother said I'm gonna be the greatest man alive. But now I'm a man, way past 21. You got to believe me, woman, I have lots of fun. I'm a man.
Sounds like people were having fun at that one.
Indeed. You always have fun in a Muddy Waters concert.
And that was Mannish Boy.
Yeah.
Which was that not something he did in the early 50s?
Yeah, he did. Absolutely.
And that one was sort of the, correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds kind of like the prototype for a lot of these other tunes that came along with that same da-da-da, like
yeah.
I'm a Man
yeah.
by
yeah.
Bo Diddley.
Yeah.
And even another Muddy Waters song called, what was it, Hoochie Coochie Man.
Yeah, Hoochie Coochie Man.
Yeah. And maybe more. But that's da-da-da.
Da-da-da.
That was, well, last week, you know, I was playing part of a tribute to Lux Interior. I was playing that Cramps tune, Hard Working Man,
yeah.
which was done by Captain Beefheart.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that had that same pattern.
Yep.
Ba-da-da-da. Yeah.
I'm a hard working man.
I am, yeah. Well, and I wouldn't necessarily describe this as hard work, but we have been here for almost 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, these have been three honest hours. With Daddy O'Dilly, our studio guest, paying homage tonight to Maxwell Davis and Jesse Stone. We got time for one more, Maxwell Davis, and for any final words from Daddy O'Dilly prior to departing these studios.
Well, our program tonight was sponsored by Gillette Razor Blades, and our closing theme song, in fact, is Look Sharp by Maxwell Davis and his group, and yes, this is the theme song to the Friday night primetime boxing matches that used to be seen on ABC in the 1950s. As I recall, there were enough complaints about boxing during primetime, and boxing was relegated to later hours on television back in those days. Yeah, and but this catchy tune is still remembered to this day. Gillette Razor Blades. Look sharp, feel sharp, be sharp.
It was the Friday night fights?
That's what I recall, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, feel sharp, look sharp, be sharp.
That's right.
Away we go. Rock House returns next Wednesday, and we are working on a tribute to John Neal as Black History Month continues on Rock House. Thanks for showing up tonight, Daddy O'Dilly.
Once again, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me in here, Marshall.
A good time was had by all, especially me. And now one more Maxwell Davis selection. Yes. We could make a minor correction. This is not Look Sharp. This is one called Ooh. Like O-O-H, exclamation point. Ooh. Ooh. Ah. Ooh. It's twine time. No, actually, it's time to look sharp and to be sharp. Even if on occasion I cue up the wrong cut. Hey, it happens. It could happen to you if you were doing the show instead of me. So, just remember one last thing. Everybody needs somebody to love. And you might be that someone.